You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 11th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable but snowy Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we will not be live today, but of course that doesn't matter to thousands of you who always listen to this show via podcast. Because of technical difficulties, Matt and Michael couldn't make it into the office today. That's right. They got hangnails. Well, apparently they're claiming to be snowed in. We figured to dodge a bullet.
Well, I'm right here right now.
Well, yes, I know. Sorry to make fun of you in front of your face, as if you were not here. However, ladies and gentlemen, we've got two great interviews for you, despite our not being there. First one is from filmmaker Benny Bruner, who has here to talk about his near one-hour documentary entitled The Great Book Robbery, which is the story of how the National Library in Israel collected the private books of Palestinians driven out of the major cities in the 47-48 conflict, I guess the first of many, in Israel or Palestine, as it was called at that time. Fascinating film, very insightful guy. You will enjoy that interview. And then we'll be talking to K.C. Boyd, who has written a novel entitled Being Christian, about what drove her to write this story of the Dominionists. So enjoy both those interviews. We will be back live tomorrow, Tuesday. On Wednesday, we will be recapping and following up on the President's State of the Union address. On Thursday, we'll have a different show, and then on Friday, we'll have another show.
With the return of Cliff Schechter.
With the return of Cliff Schechter. Yes, indeed. Enjoy today's program. We will be back live on Tuesday. And don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member, blah, 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 at majority.fm. I don't even have the effort. If Matt and Michael won't come in today, why should I do that? All right, folks, see you live tomorrow. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You know them. They're the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You can get a free audiobook download now at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. In honor of Code Pink storming the Brennan hearings last week, why not pick up Medea Benjamin's Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control for free, audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Get it now. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Sam Cedar on the phone. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome the director of The Great Book Robbery, a 57-minute documentary, which has been shown on Al Jazeera English. It is also screening through the U.S. through the month of February. And you can find more information at thegreatbookrobbery.org. Benny Bruner, director of The Great Book Robbery. Welcome to the program, Benny.
Hi, Sam. Glad to be here.
Full disclosure, Benny and I are friends from the film circuit. I had the opportunity to go see Benny's film the other night at Columbia University, and it's a fantastic film. And, Benny, just briefly, just give us what it is that you set out, what story you set out to tell when you started to make this film.
The Great Book Robbery is basically the story of at least 70,000 looted Palestinian books. The books were looted or systematically looted by the Israeli librarians of the Israeli National Library together with the Army during the 1948 war.
And this took place in primarily the major cities in Israel, Palestine at that time.
Yes.
Jerusalem.
Yes.
Haifa, Jaffa.
Nazareth.
And so just walk us through a little bit about how this takes place, because to say that the library was looting, I mean, it's just, I think it's hard for people to sort of just grasp. What were the mechanisms of this?
Okay. Well, one has to remember, let me lay out the context of this historical event. There was a lot of looting taking place in 1948, especially in the urban centers, the ones you mentioned, Jerusalem, Jaffa, Haifa. So what happened was that, especially in Jerusalem, it started there, the soldiers and the authorities noticed that individuals, you know, the Jews, residents of Jerusalem, would go into abandoned Palestinian homes, mainly of middle-class and upper-middle-class Palestinians, and they would loot the contents of these houses, carpets, furnitures, pianos, you name it. Some of the soldiers mentioned to the army first and later on to the librarians of the National Library that they saw many, many books in some of these homes. So that triggered the management of the National Library to put in motion what they called at the time a salvage operation to rescue these important books, many of them very important, and to bring them to the library for safekeeping until they can return them to their rightful owners. So something that started with a good intention very quickly in a matter of weeks or some months has been transformed basically into a organized looting, because they very quickly, the librarians especially, decided that the books are better served if they will be kept in the National Library.
And the fascinating thing about your film is that it, in many respects, and perhaps, you know, and I guess it depends on which context we're talking about when we talk about conventional wisdom, but certainly the mainstream narrative of the founding of the State of Israel is that when Israel was founded, it was essentially a land without people. And one of the things I think that your film does remarkably well, in a way that I, you know, granted, I have limited exposure to just seeing films these days, but does remarkably well, is it paints a picture of a thriving intellectual and artistic culture that existed prior to that existed amongst the Palestinian people living there. Just give us a sense of what it was like in these cities for the Palestinian middle class.
Okay, first of all, let me refer to the founding myth that you mentioned in your question. You know, the Zionist slogan was concerning Palestine. A land without a people for a people without a land, the Jews being the people without a land. Well, not only that there was a people in Palestine, there were about, in 48, there were about 1 million Palestinians, even a little bit more, and they managed to establish between 1917, when the Brits took over the place from the Ottoman Turks, they managed to establish a vital, thriving cultural scene in the big centers of Palestine, Jerusalem, Jaffa, Haifa, Nazareth. You know, newspapers. Jaffa was a major center for printing at least 4 or 5 national newspapers in Arabic. And the center for publishers, book publishers. Jerusalem had very advanced schools, advanced even in today's terms. You had the theater groups traveling from Egypt to Lebanon, and in the way making the stop in Haifa to perform. There was, you know, you had theater, you had cinema, the full Monty, so to speak. So it was a lively, thriving, vibrant cultural scene, and that has been lost in 1948. And the whole thing of my film is that it talks about, it deals with this aspect of the Palestinian catastrophe, or the Nakba, as they call it, from this aspect. It was never talked, really, hardly mentioned, and due to the fact that a PhD student, Israeli PhD student, who about 5 years ago found these documents that attest to this event, that, you know, that saved it from going into oblivion.
And talk about this. One of the fascinating things that that is related in your film is this sort of cultural connection between Beirut and Cairo and Damascus that would run through. I guess it was a Jaffa or a Haifa.
Haifa. Yes.
And via a railway line. I mean, it has, you know, it has the same feel of, you know, having grown up in the northeast of this country, you had these major urban centers that were just a couple hours away from each other via train. And this created just a thriving sort of mixture of ideas and art and whatnot. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. You know, you have to look at it as one space. Although Palestine had its own mandatory British mandatory borders, but culturally speaking, it was one space. There was almost free movement of people, goods, culture between Cairo, Haifa, Jaffa, Jerusalem, Beirut, Damascus. It was a free flow. It was, you know, it's, you can look at it as United States today, where, you know, theater groups and books and films are moving freely between the East and the West Coast.
And so let's talk
the
about...
The same goes to Palestine. Sorry?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Hello?
Benny?
So the same goes. The same goes for the scene in Palestine of the time between 1917 and 1948 under the British rule. It was open borders basically. You needed some documentations, but very basic. So people just moved around and did their business, whatever it was, commerce or culture.
And so, I mean, so you've described in your film, you've described this sort of this context that is contrary to the conventional wisdom. Give me a sense of why you think this. I mean, as an American Jew, as an American citizen, at the very least, and you are you're living in Denmark, but you were born in Israel.
In the Netherlands. Not yet. I don't live in Denmark yet.
Oh.
I live in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam.
Apologies. And but okay. That could be in your future. One never knows. But I mean, the conventional wisdom here, the narrative is, or at the very least, there's been an absence of discussion of the presence of any type of vital Palestinian community, or one that was one which we could relate to from our narrow perspective, you know, in the European or American society. What do you think accounts for that? I mean, is it a function of a narrative that has political expediency and value to a Zionist perspective? Is it part of the fact that because the center of or the centers of Palestinian culture were dispersed in such a dramatic and sudden fashion that there was no way to tell this story? I mean, what accounts for this?
I think basically it's a mixture of all the different points you mentioned. I think there is a strong Orientalist look of the West towards the East. In other words, we don't see the East as it is. We see we relate to an imaginary East that we created in our own imagination. There is a colonial aspect to it as well, that, you know, we look down on them, the natives, and we are the possessors of a higher culture, a better one, a more advanced one. Then there is this lingering Western guilt towards the Jews. That's to do with the Holocaust, of course. You know, it's a mixture of all that, and of course, the let's not forget the major role of the Jewish lobby in this country, which is powerful and can dictate quite a lot of the way the political establishment, but not only, also the media, relate to Israel, to Palestine, to the Arabs, to Islam. I think the sooner we recognize and acknowledge that you know, the Palestinian had a culture, a thriving one, the Muslims are not all terrorists, and so on, the better will be for everybody involved. It's a journey. We have to work on it, to keep knocking on the door, and keep mentioning it, that, you know, history has been different. There were people who lived there. There were a culture. There were libraries, and all this, you know, all the topics that we discussed in this talk and I raised in my film.
How pervasive is the awareness of the existence of Palestinian culture prior to 1948? How much awareness is that amongst Israelis?
I would say close to none, almost zero, nada. There was a big article published in one of the Israeli dailies, Haaretz, sometime in mid-December 2012, just before I went to Israel-Palestine to tour with my film. And it was interesting to note some of the talkbacks. You know, I don't know how you call it here, when people, readers, react to an article and write something.
The comments.
Comments, yeah. In Israel, they call it talkbacks.
Okay.
Anyway, some of them were really revealing. People just ask, what culture are you talking about? Palestinian culture? Did they have writers? Did they have a language? What they could do beside mixing hummus and eating it? How can you talk about Palestinian culture? And I think it's very revealing, basically, although it probably came from some right-wingers in Israel. I think it's a revealing notion. And of course, also the response that I got from a leading 1948 Israeli historian, Benny Morris, when I told him what I'm busy with, that goes back a couple of years now, he told me, you know, this historical event, I heard of it, he told me about the collection of the books, the looting of the books. But I want to tell you, I don't consider it even as a footnote in the history of 1948. And when I told him, listen, you cannot say on the destruction of urban centers and the destruction of a culture as a footnote. He said, well, I don't think so. It is not more than a footnote. So when it comes from somebody in his position and with his knowledge, it's very telling.
And people should know that Benny Morris is a historian who wrote the book "The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem."
Exactly.
In 1947.
Yeah, yeah. He's very important. Used to be very important. Still is important in the history of the. Of 1948 and the ongoing Israeli-Arab or Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He was the first, indeed, the book that you mentioned that was published in the mid-1980s was the first one actually to put to rest this myth that we Israelis didn't expel any Palestinians. Because he was in the right place at the right time when a lot of military and state documents became available. And it just showed how systematically the expulsion was and how it was done.
And you ended up making a film entitled Al Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe.
Yes.
But I mean, how do you,
yes.
how do you reconcile his perspective on it being such a small footnote? What does that mean? I mean, for someone who had written a history which had broke the prevailing narrative that yes. that the Palestinians just got up and walked away. How do you reconcile the idea that in his mind, the fact that they were not just expelled, but had a vibrant cultural life there is not relevant to the conversation?
It's not relevant to what happened in 48. That's what he says. Well, Benny Morris, one has to realize he was never on the left side. When he wrote his book, in the mid 80s. He did what he did, but he was never a lefty or what you call a liberal. And in time, and as events took place, and wars, and suicide bombers, and so on, that you know, the whole bloody history of that place. What he did, he moved more and more to the center, and then he moved to the right. And he lost the little empathy and sympathy that he had to the Palestinian tragedy. And so he became sort of indifferent. So, and that's horrible. That's the fact that he.
But let me ask you this. I mean, I'm less interested in Benny Morris, the person, than I am the impetus to deny the relevance of that, when to deny the relevance of a vibrant, because, you know, from a historical perspective, if it's relevant from a historical perspective, you know, as to the expulsion of Palestinians, it surely must be relevant as to what they were doing there.
Yes, that's what I'm mentioning. I mean, I'm not discussing Benny Morris the person or Benny Morris the historian. I'm discussing Benny Morris the phenomena that, you know, points to a larger attitude of so many Israelis, the majority of them, unfortunately. And that's, it's. I think most Israelis lost, or maybe many of them never possessed, the ability to sympathize with the other side, to realize that our triumph, our ability to establish a state after so many years in exile and living as you know, as a people without a state, came on the foothills of another people's tragedy. That's the inability to realize the biblical injustice, if you like, that was that we created in 1948. That's the main problem, and it's quite painful when it comes from somebody like Benny Morris, who knows so much about, you know, he knows so much information about the events of 1948 and what even came before that and after that, but seems to understand so little about what it means, what it stands for, what we did to another people.
Has he seen the film? I mean, I don't mean to focus on Benny Morris,
on
but
Benny Morris. I don't know. I don't think so.
I mean,
but occasionally we meet because you know, when he travels to Europe for his businesses, or when I'm in Israel, we sometimes meet. So next time I'll give him the DVD, and I wonder what he will say.
Yes, I mean, I'm curious because obviously when you make a film like this, you're creating a record, but you want to have an impact on the current state of I guess of perception of.
On the discussion.
What do you hope? What do you hope when a viewer who has either been unaware of the Palestinian cultural life that was dispossessed, or one who feels like it's irrelevant? What do you hope that they walk away? And what impact do you hope that the film will have?
Well, I hope that, first of all, people will get aware of the existence of a Palestinian culture and a people, and the fact that this monumental injustice happened to them, was done to them, and that people will open their hearts. I mean, the sort of people you mentioned will open their heart and let in develop some sympathy and empathy with the Palestinians, and if they want to take a stand, maybe they can write to their congressman or congresswoman and, you know, say, vote with your conscience next time that you vote on a Middle Eastern policy something.
This is your fifth film, I think. Is that right? That's been released at this point?
This is my 15th.
Oh, 15th. I'm sorry. You know, your about section is a little bit thin, Benny, on the great book robbery. But overall, I mean, thematically, what is it that you're trying to do with your documentaries?
I'm trying to tell a different narrative, and a narrative that is little known, especially in this country, a narrative that I think is closer to what really happened. And I'm trying to, you can look at it as a counter narrative. I think decency calls to tell what we really did, and also calls to say that it's time to get the record straight. I think it's essential for us Israelis to acknowledge the true meaning of 1948 in order to be able to move forward. I think we are stuck by the denial and by the refuse to acknowledge the real event of 1948 and our real impact on the other side. It's you know, we are stuck, and we'll remain stuck as long as we don't acknowledge it. So in this respect, I see myself as an Israeli patriot. Though I'm sure most of the Israelis, not only these on the right, will say that I'm a traitor.
Well, Benny Bruner, director of the Great Book Robbery, you can check it out at thegreatbookrobbery.org. Dates while Benny is still in the United States, and information on that film and how to purchase a DVD for yourself. Benny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. It was a pleasure.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone is Casey Boyd. She is the author of the new novel, Being Christian, a rather dark look into the world of, I'll let her describe what type of Christianity. Casey, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, give me a sense of like how would you describe the world of Christianity that Being Christian examines?
Well, you know, I think an easy way for people to get their hands around this or minds around this is to think about what went on in this past summer during the primaries when we had the Republican candidates jockeying for who could be the most conservative, who could be the most religious, who could be the most Christian. And we're talking about this subset of Christianity that's very, very rigid. I actually see them as extremist. I see them as extreme as fundamentalist Muslims or as some of the real right-wing Orthodox Jews or Zionist Jews. And these are when people get fixed on their book and in their religion that they actually would like to rule countries according to their religious book. And these Christians are the same ones who are homeschooling their children or, and teaching them about creationism and that abortion and homosexuality are, tools of the devil. So it's that very extremist wing, but unfortunately it's much larger than most people think it to be. And one thing I've found is since this Obama's reelection, the thinking has sort of gone back to, saner minds have prevailed and we don't need to worry about these nuts. But just take a look at what's going on with the healthcare initiative with Obama, or when you see what's going on with the Boy Scouts. And to me right now, the biggest thing going on is Chuck Hagel's nomination, because I see what this subset of Christianity is doing to try to undermine this nomination.
You know, it's fascinating because I mean we're talking about dominionists in many respects, and
yes.
The sort of, I guess, Christian Reconstruction movement in many respects, and I think you're right. I mean, this has been a the daylight between what we perceive as the conservative base in this country and this type of fundamentalist thinking is pretty narrow. And mm-hmm. Now I'm curious as to, I want to hear, well, tell us how you came to write the book and why you wrote this in a novel form. You've done a lot of research on dominionists. I want to talk about Hagee, and I want to talk about the Koofies.
Yes, talk about them. I could talk about them forever because I think they're so dangerous.
Well, and now, but first off, tell, like, how did you come to write this book? What was the impetus? And at what moment did you know that you had to write this book?
Well, I live in Ohio, and I started out when Ken Blackwell was running for governor here, and he was doing so basically on a dominionist platform. We all know about his election stealing. We all know how he was rigging things, and quite frankly, I think he did steal the election for Bush in 2004. I don't think there's any question. When he went on to run for governor, he was using his taxpayer-funded website to promote these character principles, which come straight out of a sort of a horror kind of story. There's a guy named Bill Gothard out in Kansas or somewhere, who's got these very, very rigid principles of Christianity that include submission, and this is what Blackwell was putting up on his website. So it turned out that I had the opportunity to see him speaking from a pulpit in Ohio, and where he was campaigning, and he actually said, when asked if I think there should be a separation of church and state in this country, you will hear me say yes. And then he points to the audience and he said, but you and I both know the truth, that the only way to salvation is through our Lord Jesus Christ. Then he repeated it with like a wink and a nod. So here was my introduction to, what code speak could be, what dog whistling could be. And I started following it. And it was pretty, there was a lot of rich material here in Ohio. There was a group called the Ohio Restoration Project, and they were basically forming a kind of pyramid to get the religious right involved in election politics, and they were crossing all kinds of lines. Then I started traveling to some of the things across the country and seeing, some of our very, very prominent politicians speaking, saying the most Islamophobic, homophobic kind of hate-filled rhetoric that the people were just, standing up and cheering, speaking in their tongues. It was, it reminds me of, I'm not going to make comparisons, but you just get very charismatic individuals up on stages and you really rally these folks, and you've got them. And a lot of these people were disadvantaged people. The other thing that I saw, other than just the political danger, was how they were robbing their congregants. How some of these people had hardly had 2 cents to rub together, but they were giving the 2 cents that they had. So I did a lot of reading, a lot of research, watched a lot of these pastors on television, and realized that no matter how much I knew, most people around me either weren't interested, didn't believe it, or just didn't know about it. So I decided that I would try to write what I'd seen, create a novel about it. And I have a pretty vivid, active imagination, so I just sort of created a character. He became very real in my mind. And I sat there and went as dark and deep and steamy as I could.
And why fiction? I mean, as opposed to...
Because I think that people, we're a story-based culture, and I think that we respond to stories. That you can see it on some of the better cable TV. If you know, there was Big Love. There was even a season of Dexter where they touched upon. They didn't touch upon. It was about apocalyptic beliefs. I think that you can grab people with characters. Characters suddenly become real. To me, it was my sort of inspiration was, believe it or not, was Elmer Gantry.
Mm. And why?
Because I think that Elmer Gantry opened people's eyes to this sort of scamming con artist kind of religion. But unfortunately, I think that what we are seeing today has gone so far beyond that. And so I actually think of it as like Elmer Gantry on mega steroids, because it's the way that, you know, everything in our world has become so hyped that it's very easy to create wonderful entertainment and show around even religion. And, you know, I think one of the things that religion does, and I really respect it, is it provides community for people. And I think that we're all searching for community of some sort. Well, these guys know how to take advantage of it. They know how to take your money. And unfortunately now they have learned how to play the political game.
And let's talk about that a little, because I actually, I've been talking to, it's been very well documented that much, and you mentioned the Hegel hearings, that
yes,
much of what we perceive to be, I mean, there's obviously, when it comes to Israel,
yes,
there's obviously a very well-funded, very wealthy, maybe not so much broad-based appeal within the Jewish community for
right,
this Israel lobby, but certainly well-funded. There's a lot of very conservative Jewish activists who, share a very sort of hawkish perspective when it
yeah,
comes to Israel. But the lesser-known story is the intense lobby and power of the Christian Zionist movement in this country.
Right.
And,
right,
John Hagee, one of those figures. But tell me about Kufi. What is Kufi?
Kufi is an organization that Hagee formed in 2006 when he wanted to create basically a Christian Zionist organization. And it's been enormously successful. He now has over 1 million members.
This is Christians United for Israel.
Christians United for Israel, otherwise known as Kufi. And a lot of people still don't even know who Hagee is. Hagee he became a little more visible during the McCain run because he endorsed McCain, and then it came out some of the things he'd said, and McCain had to back away from him. But, you know, even this past year, Gingrich went out to meet with him and get his endorsement. So, you know, the players were still going to him because Hagee and these other guys control a pretty sizable voting block. And, you know, what they say pretty much goes. A lot of people get their only information from their pastors. And a guy like Hagee, who's on countless Christian television stations every day, he's coming into people's homes on a daily basis. So he forms this organization. Their purpose is severalfold. They hold, at the beginning, they were holding nights to honor Israel around the country. They're still holding them, but at the beginning, they were teaming up with Jewish federations. And I was so appalled that these Jewish federations would lend their names to these nights with Hagee. And I tried very hard to reach the right people, and doors would just shut. People would get angry. You know, if you're Jewish, you certainly cannot say a word against Israel. If you're not Jewish, it's all the more so. And I think what these Christian Zionists and what Hagee has done is, I think they've put Israel in far more danger, because their end goal is to fill the land of Israel, to repopulate it. They've given tens of millions of dollars to repopulate the settlements, the disputed territories, with Ethiopian and Russian Jews, and pretty much let them know they're not to leave. And they just want to fill these boundaries that are prescribed in the Bible and initiate the second coming. It's all really, let's get these Jews back to Israel, then Jesus will come and the Jews will all die in a river of blood, except for, I think it's 144,000 of them. So
yeah, I was
going
to say, I thought it was two-thirds. I mean, because I had expressly tried to make a reservation to be one of the one-third.
Well, you know what? If you read the book,
horribly
you'll see
allergic
that I've got a couple references
eternal
about
hellfire.
You know, where you're going to be going at the end times. But I'm appalled that, to me, this is a Faustian bargain of ginormous proportions. And you know, when you have a figure like Abe Foxman from the Anti-Defamation League approving of what Hagee does, albeit he's holding his nose, but I think that approving of anything that these people do is what in the end will actually cause anti-Semitism.
Now let me ask you, from the perspective of Kufi, I understand why it's an organizing principle, because it is a fundamentalist reading of the Bible, and it ties up with a huge end times narrative, which is important, I guess, to maintain some type of cohesion of the group in this instance. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that it's gone even beyond that, because ostensibly, right? I mean, you leave unto Caesar that which is Caesar.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and they have become expressly political, entering into the profane world. I mean, that is, when we talk about Elmer Gantry, in many respects, that seems to be sort of what has changed over the years. I don't know if the existence
of
fundamentalists.
I absolutely agree with you.
I mean, how did that develop, and how does that play into what they're doing? I mean, and what does that tell us about the level of sincerity, or what the machinations involved in creating those relationships? What does that tell us about the leadership of these movements?
Well, you know, if you think back even, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, the kind of religious talk now that is required by politicians would have been unthinkable. And so we began that slippery slope of how Christian you were became almost as important as what your other credentials were. And people began to accept that. And I think that you know, it's sort of like boiling the proverbial frog, is how we have gotten to where we are now, where, you know, it's okay to, it's more than okay, you have to be able to profess your great Christianity, even while with the one hand you're taking away from the poor. It's all a bunch of lies, and we know that. How did we get here is, I think it's all a political game. I think politicians saw votes in blocks. I think in today's world, we have a substantial portion of the population who are in economic distress, and I think that increases the tendency to lean on religion, and also to put more faith in the promise of something better in another life. Why wasn't it so in Elmer Gantry? Probably has to do, I would think, with the media and the availability that these people have to get their messages across. It's the only thing I can figure.
And at one point, I think, too, the Republican Party sort of realized that this was an incredibly powerful, cohesive group that could match, you know, what I think the Democrats had, say, in terms of unions. They don't have that anymore, but
right,
we still have
right.
these series of mega churches around the country that function as
right. – Right. Well, you know, and this all started back after the Goldwater election, and you hit the 60s and the 70s, and you see all this liberal activism, and nobody really stopped to think, well, what's the other side thinking? What are they doing? You know, they were so appalled by what they were seeing in the free love and all that stuff. They were forming organizations, you know, things like the Heritage Foundation, or you had that Richard and Betsy DeVos who are up in Michigan. They started forming these organizations, and they've been working on that since then. So suddenly we hit the Bush era, the George W. era. And Karl Rove realizes Onward Christian Soldiers, we can use these people, you know, as a voting block. And they've got this great organization, structure, funding, everything. And the Democrats are, like, left with their mouths hanging wide.
Go ahead. Coming from, you know, being based in New York, the mm-hmm. sort of the awareness, I think, is in some respects, or at least the awareness of the problematic aspects of this growing fundamentalist movement, or mm-hmm. and maybe it's not mm-hmm. necessarily growing, but it seems to be maybe less growing in scope, but growing greater in depth, I should mm-hmm. say, that mm-hmm. we have an increasingly polarized electorate, and perhaps on some level, I think what we're seeing is the marginalization, or rather not necessarily the marginalization, but the polarization. There's a growing awareness that these people are out of step in some respects. I mean, we're seeing it with the changes just in the past year or two, whether it's in terms of abortion rights or whether it's in terms mm-hmm. of homophobia. Mm-hmm. whether it's in many respects in terms of immigration, obviously the Hagel nomination, we're still seeing some of that. We're still seeing the implications of this, obviously, but in Ohio, I mean, when is there an awareness? I mean, and I think in many respects, much of the social liberalism in this country. The reason why it has been strengthened and, you know, with younger people basically explicitly mm-hmm. rejecting these visions,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
has that permeated in your experience in, you know, places like Ohio, where there may not be the same sort of sensitivity to this going
right.
on, and yet that, you know, once that higher level of awareness is there, I mean, certainly maybe it's under young people, but, and I haven't seen the numbers, but I would imagine, frankly, you know, in New York, people are much more sensitive to the implications of this rather than, you know.
Absolutely. On both coasts. No, I don't think it's really permeated here. You know, and I have a feeling even in the East, when you start to go out to, you know, what you call the exurbs, that's where you start to see these kinds of people. I know in Ohio, you go out to the exurbs, and it's actually very lily white. It's very, you know, June and Ward Cleaver kind of thing. And it's all this sort of self-superiority and these people who think that they're so moral and upright. I think what you were speaking of earlier is very true. I think what we're seeing now from the religious right is an almost sort of demographic panic, because all those issues you're talking about that the young people just don't care that much about are going to change things. On the other hand, I will also tell you that they play a really good long game. And we don't play such a great long game. Some of the issues I think are terribly important today, or like school choice. You know, to even call it school choice is like calling the anti-abortion movement pro-life. Because school choice is all about getting kids into religious education. That's it, period. You can hear that it's about getting better education for inner-city children. It's not. It's about religious education. There was just a study also that came out of Texas, out of the Texas Freedom Network, describing the impact of a ruling back in 2006 or 7, where Texas schools are now forced to offer courses on the Bible as an elective, and there was supposed to be supervision of how that was handled, but there hasn't been. So you've got whole school districts that are basically sort of fundamentalist Christian school districts. So you take that kind of that one tactic. You take the tactic of school choice, and you see money that's pouring out of public education and going into voucher systems, and you start to realize there is a long game here. There's a game to try to grab onto some of these young minds. Have you heard about the Creation Museum in Northern Kentucky?
I have indeed. I'm sitting here almost holding a blow-by-blow description of the museum that my brother-in-law. But yes, I've
okay. Well, I've been there and I've taken people there, and I find it to be, if I were a child, I would find it to be enormously seductive. It's lots and lots of fun. It's so state of the art, and it's really pegs itself as a museum. You should see the busloads of children or the groups of homeschooled children that are just like following along behind their mother and father, and hear the way that they're speaking and the way that they're thinking, and realize that these children are going to grow up, and they're going to in turn either go to Oral Roberts or Regent University, or join in politics, or become school teachers, and they will be forming the next generation. And that's what I mean by the long game. They also have lots and lots and lots of children.
Yes, indeed. Well, the book is Being Christian, a novel by Casey Boyd. We have a link to it on the site at majority.fm. Casey,
you know, and I want to say one thing, Sam,
please.
Which is I really do encourage people to read it almost for the fun of it, because you'll walk away realizing how dark this whole thing is, but you'll have had a lot of fun, steamy kind of read. So it's a great way to get up to speed on these awful people.
Well, I appreciate that. Casey Boyd, thanks so much for coming here and talking
Thank
to us
you.
About
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Say to Apple Pay.